All right, everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, administrator. And our first guest today is Charles Lewis. He's the founder and the director of the Center for Public Integrity. They've just finished their third book in a series. It's called The Buying of the President, 2004. Who's really bankrolling Bush and his Democratic challengers, and what they expect in return? Welcome to the show, sir.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. It's an excellent book. I only got it 2 days ago. I'm a little more than halfway through it. Actually, I got up to the challengers part. It's where
wow.
I ran out of time. But
that's impressive that you did that much.
Yeah, well, I got fired, so I didn't have too much to do, but sit around. Anyways, it's an excellent book, and you have in here the top 50 donors to Bush through his whole lifetime, the top donors to the Republican Party, and, as it says in the title, what all those donors expect in return for their support. And well, I guess we should start at the beginning, where the book begins with the assertion that since 1976, the candidate with the most money wins. In the book, you call this a private referendum a year before the vote is even cast.
Right. Well, basically, and seriously, I mean, it's just one of those dirty little secrets of politics that very few people realize, that the presidential candidate in every presidential election since Jimmy Carter in 1975-76, the candidate raising the most money the year before the election has gotten the nomination of his party without exception. Now, we're talking about candidates who are eligible for matching funds, or in other words, don't write checks for $80 million or something, like Ross Perot. Folks who are participating in the process as it was constructed, which is almost all the candidates. And so if you go 75, 79, 83, 87, 91, 95, 99, at December 31st, midnight, the person who had the most cash that they had raised ended up getting the nomination of their party. And, you know, it was Bush and Gore in 99, and right now that would appear to be, obviously, Bush, who raised $130 million last year, the year before the election, which is just in another stratosphere. No one in politics has ever come anywhere close to that number. And on the Democratic side, it's Howard Dean, who raised $40 million. Now, that doesn't mean history couldn't, you know, sort of be shattered and that a new president couldn't be set. I'm not telling people they shouldn't vote. What I'm saying is that a lot of folks, 90% of these maximum contributions you can now make of $2,000, 90% of that money is put down on the candidates the year before the election. And frequently, candidates drop out, as five leading Republicans did in 99, because Bush sucked all the air out of the room. He raised $37 million in 3 months, and Elizabeth Dole and Dan Quayle and all these big-name Republicans just were seen as sort of not worthy, you know, by the check-writing elites in the country. A check of $1,000 or $2,000 comes from 0.1% of the country. 96% of the American people don't give a penny to any politician or party at the national level. So you have this process that starts not in Iowa, not in New Hampshire, but with the people writing checks. And you can really see a lot of what is going to happen by looking closely at what happened last year or before any election year. And that's sort of partly what we do in this book. We also, as you noted, mostly are telling people the inside skinny about every candidate that you won't see in their ad or their website.
Well, I was going to say, I suppose you already addressed this, but I know a certain argument would be made that the candidates raising their money is sort of the democratic process itself, that, hey, if Libby Dole can't raise the money to be the nominee, why should she be the nominee?
Right. No, it's a fair point. I mean, the problem you get into, or at least the issue on the other side of that, is if a candidate is usually successful in bundling contributions together, 67 company executives all give the maximum check on the same day, including their spouses and their dog or something, and they are managed to put together astonishing astronomical sums, yes, that is a feat of organization. It's an incredibly impressive thing. No one disputes that. But is it possible there are a lot of people that don't have any interest in going around to hundreds of fundraising events with frozen smiles and day in and day out trying to raise that kind of cash and put together those kinds of organizations? And by the way, why would an industry give that kind of money, not just because they're patriotic Americans? There's usually something else going on there, and which is part of what we do in the book. We look at what they get back. But there's a symbiotic relationship between these donors, many of them, not all of them. Some are giving just because they believe in the candidate and they have some extra money and they want to contribute. We understand that that happens a lot. But the patterns are that certain industries want things, and not just industries, labor unions, depending on who the vested interest is, they want to get close to power and they want to get their, they have an agenda and they're investing in the process and investing in the candidates. And that, you know, but Abraham Lincoln and Harry Truman have participated to the extent you have to, running for 2 full years and hanging out with people that write checks, or else being a millionaire yourself and spending millions of dollars on your own campaign. That is not, some would say that's not hugely democratic. Your point's well taken. You can find lots of people, and that's impressive that you have organization. The other problem is the media. When people raise a lot of money the year before the election, the media covers that because there's nothing else to cover, frankly. There's no primaries or caucuses. And so then the media swirls around a candidate as having quote-unquote momentum or quote-unquote effective organization, and then they are essentially anointed as inevitable fait accompli type, you know, the candidate for the White House for that party. And so the fact is there are lots of other people that would probably be very good presidents, but they're not willing to subject themselves to this kind of a process. And there are minor candidates who may be the most thoughtful or most eloquent, but they have not gone to these lengths, almost superhuman lengths, that some find demeaning and, you know, humiliating. You know, so it depends, and you're right, there are different views of this. I mean, this is my view, and
I think it's an important point, yeah, that 0.1% of the population are the ones donating to the campaigns overall, and that everybody else,
right,
is just sitting out.
Yeah, 100 million Americans actually are not voting in any federal election, at least 100 million every single time we have elections. So something is not quite right here, I would argue.
As an illustration of the point of how much the amount of money raised the year before the primaries, you bring up the case in your book of Bush versus McCain in South Carolina in the primaries in 2000, and how, now, McCain was seen, which I'm not choosing sides of either of these two, but
sure,
McCain was seen as the real reformer, and somehow in a matter of a week or so, George W. Bush came and completely turned that mantle around on John McCain, right?
Yeah. What was the reason I talked about that is there are several reasons. One is what worried me the most as an investigative journalist is that facts don't matter. Anyone who understands or studied political reform and political reform policy in the U.S. knows that John McCain, whether or not you agree with him, has made campaign finance reform a big part of his career and, you know, had fought throughout much of the 90s to have this historic bill enacted, which was just recently enacted and upheld by the Supreme Court on reducing the, you know, soft money and those kinds of things in politics. Bush, on the other hand, George W. Bush, as governor of Texas and as presidential candidate in 99 and as president, has not been, but at that moment in 2000 when they're running each other, he had never even given a speech about cleaning up politics, and he certainly had never proposed any legislation about it. And the last national legislation vetoed on the whole subject was vetoed by his father. And so... anyone looking at their, so in New Hampshire, McCain shocks the political world and frankly himself and upsets Bush, who was considered the front runner because he had raised all that money, and win by 19 or 20 points, and suddenly McCain is on the cover of Time, Newsweek, and all the other magazines, and they go down into South Carolina, and 19 days later, McCain loses, and in polling, the reformer, in the polls is set by the voters to be George W. Bush. He had adopted a new slogan after he went back to Austin, actually, after he sort of got his political clock cleaned, essentially, by McCain. And they retooled their message, and they came up with a new phrase called the reformer with results. Now, when they were thinking of reform, they were thinking of tort reform or education reform and other things. But the voters in New Hampshire had been hearing all about cleaning up politics, which is a separate kind of reform. Anyway, they had this fine everywhere Bush went, and not to mention Bush outspent McCain 5-1. And then you have the whole other issue, and this is also important, I think. Outside groups came into it. So groups that people had never heard of descended on South Carolina from all over the country, including folks fighting for retaining the Confederate flag, and all kinds of a motley group of assortment of groups, and so they began spending millions of dollars, but they also did it on below the radar stuff like phone banking and leaflet drops and things that don't always get noticed by the media. And some of it was really nasty stuff about McCain's wife having illegitimate being a drug addict, and McCain having fathered illegitimate children, really kind of scurrilous, outrageous stuff with no proof, of course. Anyway, it just turned bitter and incredibly nasty. And political scientists who tracked it found that all the outside stuff favored Bush and trashed McCain. They couldn't find any outside groups laying stuff around the state on behalf of McCain. Then Bush wins the state, and they think he's the reformer. And it essentially stopped McCain's campaign. Right there in his tracks, really. He won one or two primaries after that, but it was the end of McCain, and it showed that outside groups and substantial sums of money,
and three-word slogans
can actually trump overwhelm the facts, frankly, regarding their records. And so it is a bit disturbing, and I mentioned it because that was repeated in Georgia, where a Senate incumbent, Max Cleland, who has McCain, we interviewed McCain for this book, as you know, and McCain said that it describes Cleland, who, unlike McCain, is a Democrat, but McCain said he left three limbs on a battlefield, and he was being compared in ads with Osama bin Laden as basically a traitor. And these ads were funded by the same groups that tried to smear and succeeded in smearing McCain in South Carolina. And so these outside groups are spending tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars assisting the parties, getting their message out and quietly aligning with these other groups. They're all like a network of groups. It's not just the candidate. It's not just the parties now. It's these outside groups. And that's part of the new reality of American politics, regardless of the McCain-Feingold historic bill. And so what's it mean for citizens? It means that big money still has a lot to do with the outcomes. It means that that we still have a little bit too much secrecy in American politics, even though we're in the 21st century. And it means that there are a lot of people up to no good behind the scenes, as we've always had in politics in America, but that's not going away. In fact, it may be increasing.
Okay, well, we're going to have to get into the McCain-Feingold thing a little bit here.
Because, sure.
When Bush signed it, he said, look, I know it's unconstitutional, but I'm going to go ahead and sign it anyway and just rely on the court to go ahead and strike out the unconstitutional part.
Right.
And the Supreme Court, of course, didn't do that. And,
right.
I have a lot of trouble with this because, on one hand, the soft money thing, it's basically the loophole is as long as they don't mention the candidate by name, then they can say whatever they want. As long as they don't endorse the candidate by name, they can say whatever they want about the other candidate. What McCain-Feingold did was say that these outside groups that you're talking about are forbidden from running television ads within 60 days of the election. And I'm just thinking, if I was one of these outside groups, if I run an ad 61 days before the election, that's not going to make a bit of difference whatsoever. And I understand how, like you're saying, these groups can come in and call a war hero a ally of Osama bin Laden and things like that. But at the same time, I mean, we don't want only the campaigns being able to advertise, right? Shouldn't me and Supreme be able to chip in and buy an ad that says, hey, look, this candidate wants to take your guns or whatever it is?
Well, no, your point's well taken. And by the way, my group, the Center for Public Integrity, does not endorse or advocate legislation, and we were not involved in the McCain-Feingold litigation or its enactment as a law. But just to clarify that, the soft money ban just banned the big checks to the parties, and the part you're describing is the issue ad. It's known as the issue ad ban of 30 days for primaries and 60 days for general election. And many constitutional scholars thought if anything was thrown out by the court, that seemed the most precarious because of the free speech considerations some believe are evident here, present here. And to everyone's astonishment, I think including McCain, probably, the court did not throw it out because, well, they felt that it, how can you regulate politics and the corruption of money that is present in politics, which the court noted and discussed in its opinion, how can you do it if some of the main actors outspending the candidates, by the way, are doing all kinds of things and no one's noticing it, and just because they don't say vote for or vote against, but they trash somebody, isn't that considered election activity? And shouldn't it be regulated in some fashion? And, you know, I will be the first to acknowledge you that that's a controversial provision, and even though the court upheld it, some people have problems with it. The other practical reality is people can still run ads and are doing it. It did it, you know, right up like 31 days before the Iowa caucuses, and people don't know who paid for it, and the disclosure for these groups, known as 527 groups, doesn't happen until 10 days after the Iowa caucuses, so the public is still in the dark about who's spending the money, even though the new law is in place. So this thing is messy, it's got problems, and, you know, it is controversial. It was the first thing that reformers managed to enact of any significance since Watergate, and you know, there are still people that think you should just disclose and have absolutely no regulation because it's hopeless ultimately to regulate money and politics. Others think that, as Madison said, if men and women were angels, there'd be no need for government, that the one unregulated industry in America substantially happens to be the political campaign industry. The Federal Election Commission is a joke. They very rarely sanction anyone, and if they do get sanctioned, they pay the fines with their campaign contribution money. And so that we have a system that's out of control with almost no regulation effectively. And so, you know, everyone differs on this. I mean, I just see a big mess where there's tons of money flowing in and the public doesn't always know what the facts are in any race, and they don't always know the facts about their candidates, and they should know it.
Right. Yeah, it's a troubling thing, I think, from any point of view of all the money in there.
Right.
You know, I mean, when you talk about the politicians regulating elections, I mean, that just makes it worse. I remember there was a thing about the third party where, okay, you can be in the debate as long as you get on the ballot in all 50 states, and then, oh, well, I mean, what we meant was you have to be polling at least 15% in all the polls. And
right.
I mean, when you let Democrats and Republicans regulate elections, they're just going to regulate it in favor of themselves and their incumbents, right?
You're absolutely right. The Federal Election Commission has three Republicans and three Democrats, no one from outside those two parties on the commission. And whenever they have to issue a subpoena for a possible violation of federal law, it's always 3-3. It's tied for some odd reason. And they just can't issue subpoenas, therefore they can't investigate hundreds of apparent violations of the law every year that the staff has identified as a potential violation. And then the debate commission, as you just mentioned, the debate commission is controlled by the two parties. There's no one from a third party on the debate commissions, and they do decide who gets to participate, which is basically no one unless they're in the two parties. And so what there is a rigged game by the two parties, and the power of the two parties cannot be underestimated. And, you know, we have a very strong in-your-face chapter about the two parties and their power and their clout. And anyone who wants to understand a presidential candidate has to also understand their party. very closely because they're two peas in a pod, and their decisions, the range of their decision making, their independence is directly related to what party they're in and the network of affiliations and alliances that that party has, including to these outside groups we mentioned.
Which is really what makes this book and the two other before it in the series, you guys wrote one for 2000 and 1996 also, right?
Right, that's
really,
right.
It really makes this indispensable because it really shows all the connections. I mean, you just flip it right
thanks.
Open and there's connection after connection.
It is kind of creepy a little bit when you... I mean, this is like looking underneath the hood of the car kind of thing. I mean, this is the kind of... This is what makes politics work, and it's sort of the... It's not the most glamorous part. In fact, it's probably the most disgusting and frustrating part of politics, the dark side, I guess you'd say, of politics. But it's not anything any candidate wants to talk about, but it is an absolute reality. The fact of the matter is you're not just electing the candidate. You're electing his or her party, and you're electing all those vested interests that are part of those relationships there. It's like when you marry someone, you marry their family. Well, in this case, the family are the sponsors of the campaigns and the process. And it's very difficult for a candidate to go against, quote-unquote, their family members, you know, in public or when they're in power, because they're part of a... There's a whole team of people there that are getting elected. When you cast your ballot, you've just voted for several things, not just that person.
All right, well, I'm going to want to spend some time on Bush and
sure.
the return on the investment that he's given all of his campaign guys. But I think real quick, maybe we can go through the Democrats.
Sure.
I was watching C-SPAN last night. And by the way, for people who are listening to this recorded later on, this is 2 days before the Iowa caucuses that we're talking here. And I saw on C-SPAN last night a John Edwards ad where that I guess is running locally in Iowa, where he says he's never taken any money whatsoever from any Washington, D.C. lobbyists. And I thought, man, really? Because that's funny. I'm going to have the director of the Center for Public Integrity on tomorrow and ask him about that. Is that true?
You know, I find that hard to believe. I mean, since we went to press, he's been talking about this, and he actually has a proposal, if he becomes president, that no president will be able to take money from lobbyists who are registered in Washington. 22 of his top 25 career patrons, we call them, are law firms and lawyers. As you know, he is a trial lawyer by background, and much of his support, I mean, a large amount of his support comes from trial lawyers all over the United States and people in those law firms. A lot of those people around the United States are not registered as lobbyists in Washington. We have not gone down. Someone needs to do what you just said and actually identify and see. It's a tedious process because there's thousands of those donors, but it's a simple affair with computers if you do it right, where you can take the registration list with lobbyists. There's 24,000 lobbyists in America registered in Washington, and then kind of cross-mesh those names with his contributor names. So we have not done that, partly because he didn't make an issue of it until the last month or two after the book had gone to the publisher. But his support is, like I said, substantially from trial lawyers, not a big surprise there. And his top, he actually has the donor that gave the most money to anyone in the entire book, which is Shangri-La Entertainment, and a particular high dollar Democratic donor named Stephen Bing from Hollywood, who together he's gotten $907,000 from them, which is really quite stunning. That's a lot of money for someone who's only been in politics at the national level, or any level actually, for less than one Senate term. So that's not a lobbyist or a lawyer. It's a Hollywood person with lots of money who is helping to get behind him, I guess you'd say.
Well, that, you know, at least doesn't bring up too many worries about what he's going to have to do to pay them back. I mean, what kind of government contract can you give a Hollywood producer?
Well, no, you're right. I mean, this fellow, Stephen Bing, is slightly, he's not as well known as he ought to be, considering how much money he's given to the Democratic Party in recent years. His alliances in Hollywood and what his priorities and his agendas are not as well known as probably they should be. But, you know, there are things like intellectual property and international trade matters and things. It depends how much he cares about the agenda of Hollywood itself and the studios and what part of Hollywood he makes up. And I'd like to, everyone should go a little, look a little closer at Bing, because the amount of money he's given is amazing, actually. But you're right. I mean, people think, oh, it's just a Hollywood producer, and that's in the eyes of the beholder. There are some Americans that would not be thrilled by that prospect. Others would think it's innocuous. It's up to each. The whole point of this book is to know who's behind them, and everyone can decide if they can handle that, you know, as they're given their own values and inclinations politically. And so that's Edwards.
All right, what about the presumed front-runner, Howard Dean?
Howard Dean is a complex character because Vermont, unlike Texas, has no campaign contribution, or has contribution limits of $400 in Vermont. So it's a little state, hardly no media, and they have campaign limits. So his numbers are anemic, as you might expect, 11 years as governor. And he's starting to get money from outside Vermont, but the amounts are what are kind of interesting. Through three quarters of his presidential campaign plus 11 years as governor, his top donor is Time Warner at $65,000, which is, again, still not huge. Remember I just said Edwards' top contributor is $900,000. So Time Warner, Microsoft, IBM are the top three contributors. He has a lot of people, like it sounds like students and professors at universities, but it looks like their employers are like Harvard and University of California and University of Pennsylvania and Stanford and Dartmouth. So he has a lot of folks from sort of, I guess you'd say, the university communities, plus some of these big epic-sized companies. But in his top 10 donor list, there's only one interest from Vermont at $19,000. But his donor list is not large. We did see in the chapter about him, he has a close alliance with, or he, as governor, had a close alliance with the leading utility company in Vermont, and his chief of staff went to work as a chief lobbyist for the utilities, and there are still ratepayers in Vermont who are angry about what they perceived as Dean's being too close, really, to the utility industry. He also was, not only does he try to keep his gubernatorial papers closed to the public, but he also, Vermont is one of the three worst states in the country for disclosure about personal finances of the governor and the state legislators. Dean never in 11 years proposed to change that or improve it, and when people in the legislature proposed it, he didn't go along with their reform proposal. So there's something about secrecy and information that is, less than terrific. I think most Americans would, you know, he would explain it away, and I'm sure he has, as the prerogative of a governor and not unusual. But it does, we did notice that there are a few occasions he has not wanted things made public in an aggressive way.
Now, in the book, you also talk about Joe Lieberman and his ties to the pharmaceutical companies, right?
Right. Lieberman is close to the pharmaceutical companies, including the biotech companies. He's very close, as you would expect, to the insurance companies, being from Connecticut, and he's close to the banks and the Wall Street interests. His top donor is Citigroup at $110,000. Then he has Hartford Financial, Goldman Sachs, United Technologies, which is a defense contractor and based in Connecticut, Chase, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, Credit Suisse, Travelers. These are all either big Wall Street firms or insurance firms. He is probably of the leading of the major Democratic candidates, he is sort of advertises himself as, and his numbers reflect that he is closest to business. He's more of a what you would call a centrist Democrat or a new Democrat or whatever, however you want to phrase it. But he is, his donor profile and his public policies are sort of more in the middle. Is more business friendly, I guess you'd say, than overtly so than the other Democrats, I'd say.
And what about John Kerry?
Kerry has a very close association with his brother's law firm, which is based in Boston, Mintz Levin. Mintz Levin has a very, very strong client base that's the telecommunications industry, namely the wireless communication industry. And Kerry has taken $230,000 from them, and he has repeatedly gone to bat for the wireless companies who are the clients of his brother's law firm and helped them get special rulings and dispensations from the Federal Communications Commission. He has got other big support. This is a three-term, 18-year U.S. senator, so he's got a lot of big blue-chip companies also that is not unusual for people in Washington a while, unfortunately. Or fortunately, depending on your perspective. Anyway, Fleet, Boston, Time Warner, Skadden, Arps, big law firm, Verner, Lipford, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs are some of his top contributors. So he's a lot of the business community, has also been supportive of him, including law firms and banks. He serves on some committees where his access to him is important by these powerful interests. So anyway, that's sort of his background. But the top one is that Mintz Levin firm that we noticed.
Okay, now, I had a great time reading about Wesley Clark in your book. The nerve of some people. This guy was a registered lobbyist when he filed for the run for president.
He was. It is interesting. He was working for a company called Axiom that was trying to get, trying to get airport security and U.S. government contracts. And so here is Wesley Clark, retired four-star general, going around and meeting reportedly with Vice President Cheney and other top administration officials on behalf of this company, getting paid as much as $800,000. And at the same time, he's on the air for CNN as a military analyst during the Iraq War, talking about homeland security, including airport security and other issues. And So at the same time he is an analyst, at the same time he's a lobbyist, he's also forming a committee to run for president simultaneously. And on the day he announces, September 17th, 2003, he is still registered before the Congress as a lobbyist for this company. And it's really, I have to say, I don't know of any time in the recent past that I can think of in the last 10 or 20 years where a major presidential candidate was a registered lobbyist in Washington. Now, after the center and others pointed out that he was a registered lobbyist, about a week later he terminated the registration. But it's, again, it's something the public should know about him.
I should have given him a few more weeks. Let him reconnect with himself. Let him get out too soon.
That's funny. Well, that's a fair point. It was starting to emerge. I mean, and there are a lot of questions about this. I mean, what we still don't. The public. We had to throw that chapter together in lightning speed and open the manuscript up after the book had been locked down. Books take months to get published, and the manuscript had been turned in August, believe it or not. And so we had to write a chapter very quickly about him, and we pulled all the relevant records. But the fact is, there's a lot about what he's done for this company and a lot of his contacts with these agencies and things that we actually still don't know. And the bottom line, again, the public should know this about him, and some people may not have a problem with that. Some others may be deeply offended, or have at least questions about it. All of it is fodder for a presidential campaign, I think, to have a conversation about it, which is the whole idea from our perspective. We don't want to have any surprises later and discover this after the guy's elected president, if that's what happens.
Right. All right. Now it's time to get to President Bush here. We talk about in your book how he raised $130 million last year, which is, I guess, mm-hmm. what, $100 million more than the front runner on the other side?
Well, that's about right. 130 to 40, so it's about $90 million more than Dean raised. But to put it in another way, in 99, Bush raised 67 or 68 million. So he almost doubled his total. And we all know inflation did not go up that much in 4 years. So when you're an incumbent president and you control the White House, therefore, and the contribution limits, don't forget, doubled from $1,000 to $2,000, one of the compromises McCain-Feingold had to do to get that law passed was to double the hard money direct contributions. So anyway, what's unusual about Bush is this pioneer system he's put together, and one thing that's new is, or most Americans don't realize, that the pioneers are, it's a system where a person agrees to raise $100,000 from their best friends, and industries, in the case of the pioneers, actually put numbers on the checks to credit the pioneer for raising the money. Anyone who raises $100 is called a pioneer. Anyone who raises $200 is called a ranger. That's a new 2004 election thing they're doing. But they want to put numbers on the checks so that the industry gets credit. Now you got to think, oh, wait a minute, why do they want credit? What's that about? Well, you know, I think I know why they.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But the other funny part is, we thought there were 222 pioneers in all the news coverage all through 2000's election. In the litigation around the U.S. Supreme Court looking into McCain-Feingold, new documents have emerged. And it turns out there were 560, almost 600, the number keeps going higher every day, pioneers. So they had 300 more pioneers than anyone knew about. And in the litigation, when people asked for the records, they said they couldn't find, they couldn't account for $60 million worth of background documentation about the people and the checks and all that kind of stuff. They sort of lost it.
No.
Which is, sounds very strange to most people. And so there's a lot of interesting stuff about the how they raise it that is, I think, a lot of people are fascinated by it. But suffice it to say, no one has raised this kind of money, but also the way he's raised it. A $1,000 check or a maximum contribution usually comes from no candidate, including Bill Clinton, who the previous fundraising champion, no one had ever found more than 19,000 people in America to write a check for the maximum amount at that time, $1,000. This guy found 58,000 people. If that gives you any idea about the 2000 election, and he's now found presumably more for this election. So his top donor is Enron, which is kind of fascinating. They were the number one donor in the Buying the President 2000 book, and his top donor in that book.
And they're still the top donor after they completely collapsed.
Well, they are. Now, some of that is a function of Texas not having any contribution limits for governors. And so he already had, you know, he already had about 500 to 550,000 when he first ran for president. So that most of that is what happened in Texas, to be honest, you know, before he even became a national figure. But it is fascinating that Enron is still there, and the new CEO, there's some Enron employees, not a lot of them, but the one or two or three that are still giving money in 2003 after they've declared bankruptcy, after they're under criminal investigation, and the Bush campaign's cashed the check, and, which, you know, that could in some situations be a controversial contribution to some, because it's such a loaded political mess, the whole Enron thing. Merrill Lynch and MBNA are closing fast, and the New York Times, interestingly, studied our 2000 book and our 2004 book, and they're absolutely correct that in 2000 there were no Wall Street big, you know, financial firms in the top 10 patrons for Bush, and now there are 6 out of 10. So the financial firms have sort of flocked to Bush. And then you think, well, what's that about? And so we're talking Credit Suisse, Goldman Sachs, International Bank of Commerce, all kinds of interesting groups. We mentioned MBNA, Merrill Lynch. What do those folks want? Well, several things. The Bush policies on cutting dividend taxes and capital gains taxes play into their own agendas as companies, but also privatizing Social Security. Who's going to get all the business? The Wall Street folks are going to, you know, they have dollar signs in their eyes for that policy.
We're already big donors to the Cheney political career too, right?
Well, yeah, they were. I mean, the financial Wall Street folks have always been kind of approximately two-thirds of their money has always kind of gone to the Republican Party. Not that Clinton didn't have a lot of it, too, but they're always big players financially in politics. What is kind of fascinating is how they have robustly embraced Bush, and we talk in the Bush chapter about also the policies on offshore money. All these big institutions don't want any real patriotic bill about hiding your money offshore because they have a lot of clients who want to keep their money offshore to either minimize their tax burden or avoid litigation or whatever their motives. And in the wake of 9/11, there's a lot of pressure internationally by the other, you know, industrialized countries in Europe and elsewhere to tighten the money laundering rules and the offshore banking rules. And the country in the world dragging its feet is the U.S. and the Bush administration. And time again, they have done what the big banks want when it comes to offshore money. And so the chapter goes into those relationships. And so that these financial institutions, this is a very exciting time for them. You know, I mean, with every one of the candidates, including the unions behind the Democrats, these interests all are tight with these guys for a reason, and you can see the mutually dependent and beneficial relationship and how both sides benefit. The politicians get the money, the interests get favors. Gephardt, I don't think we mentioned, his top donor is
Anthony. Sorry, I totally forgot him when we were
talking. Well, no, that's okay.
He's such a forgettable guy. Former Speaker of the House, right? Totally.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he always wanted to be Speaker. He didn't quite make it the Speaker, and so this is his swan song.
That's right. Tip O'Neill was the Speaker.
Yeah, whatever happens in Iowa could help decide his fate, because that's his most important state in contest, and he won that state in '88, and so anyway, Gephardt's top donor is Anheuser-Busch, which gave over $500,000 to him over the years. Now, that is in St. Louis. That is in his congressional district. And Gephardt fairly says, well, what do you expect? They're the biggest employer. I'm supposed to represent my constituents. What's the big deal? And our response is, the big deal is $500,000 that the public should know about, that if they elect Gephardt, they should know that they're electing Anheuser-Busch, that he's close to them personally. He hangs out socially with the Bush family, as in Anheuser-Busch family, and he has helped the industry on five occasions avoid being taxed, such as the Clinton health care plan. They went, there was talk, including by the president at that time, Clinton, to tax alcohol to help pay for the health care plan, and Gephardt hitched a ride on Air Force One and pigeonholed the president, pleaded with him not to tax alcohol, and Clinton dropped it, and they just were going to tax the tobacco industry instead. But the relationship is one that the public should know about. Whatever your position and whatever anyone's thoughts are about beer or alcohol or Anheuser-Busch, the public should know that there's a friendship there that goes way back. As consumers, we should know it.
Okay, now the fun part. Halliburton,
sure,
and Kellogg Brown and Root. Now, you write in your book, while Cheney was CEO of Halliburton, that they got $2.3 billion in government contracts, $1.5 billion in export-import bank loans, and I can't believe this, between 1994 and 2002, 600 government contracts for Kellogg Brown and Root.
Right. That's right. Well, think about it for a moment. Why would a company, the Houston-based oil services multi-billion-dollar company, I forget how many, it's 35 or 50,000 employees, I forget how many, but a huge company, why would they pick a guy who had been a congressman, a chief of staff to a president, defense secretary, very impressive political resume, almost zero business experience? Why would they want him as the head of their company? Well, it was his Rolodex. He knows everyone in Washington, and he actually knows heads of state all over the world as a former defense secretary. And so that meant contracts, that meant opening markets, and in Washington it meant getting more government contracts. And we, as soon as he was named to the ticket in 2000, we did a pretty interesting thing. We just took 5 years before he became CEO and 5 years while he was there, and we looked at the contributions made by the company, the political donations to politicians, and we looked at the contracts that they had gotten, and we also looked at the lobbying, how much they spent on lobbying, and everything doubled when Cheney came in. The influence payments doubled, and yes, the contracts they got back doubled. So it worked. Those investments paid off.
What kind of contracts are these? These are like building military bases overseas and that kind of thing?
Yeah, that kind of stuff. I think they're like oil type contracts. They're loans from the Export-Import Bank. They're all kinds of largesse from various federal agencies in general. But, you know, most of the conversation in the 2000 election about Halliburton was about the oil companies. You know, we have an oil company executive, and what does that mean? But the fact is, Halliburton is a very large defense contractor, as we've learned more and more in the last year because of Iraq and other things. And Kellogg, Brown, and Root, as one of the subsidiaries, has extensive number of contracts, as you just noted, 600. And Cheney was involved in the process to get Kellogg, Brown, and Root contracts when he was defense secretary back in 92 under his watch when he was secretary. They got a contract. Should there be more outsourcing of companies helping with material support of the military? And Kellogg, Brown, and Root wrote a report to the higher-ups at the Pentagon and said, this is a great idea. And then over the next 10 years, they got almost, you know, several hundred contracts of the idea that they completely endorsed as a wonderful idea. You know, welcome to the Pentagon. That's how the Pentagon works. It's a kind of a strange, I would say incestuous operation where everyone seems to know everybody, and everyone who leaves Pentagon goes to work for these companies, and they all, it's a lot of wink and nod type stuff, and it's a very circular little place, and it's not so little, but anyway, so that's the background with Halliburton, and this is, I don't know, when we went to press, we had not done this, but in October, we posted all the Iraq contracts and all the Afghanistan contracts with 73 Freedom of Information requests, 6 months with 20 people looking into that stuff. So anyone interested in that part of Halliburton, we found that Halliburton had their contracts were double the value of any other company in the country, more than twice the number two company receiving contracts, which was Bechtel. Halliburton's donations to the two parties, 95% to the GOP. So it's just interesting, we can't say, and no one can flatly say that the Iraq contracts were, a lot of them seem to be not competitively bid, but no one can directly link the personal specific involvement of the vice president. Freedom of Information Act doesn't apply to the vice president. We don't know who he talks to, who he meets with. But the other thing is, everyone in Washington knows that that's his former company. So, I'm not sure, to discuss it a second, that it would be necessary for him to pick up the phone. All we know is they've done very well in Afghanistan and Iraq. And
you write in your book that they cut their lobbying costs by half right before they got a $7 billion contract.
Right.
So they must,
right.
They must have a lot of confidence in their former CEO.
Right. Yeah, I mean, at some point, why do you need it? You know, what do you need that's going to be any better than your former CEO as vice president? You don't need to have a big, huge office. You have access instantly.
Okay, well, what do you say to a Republican who comes back and says, well, but there's nobody else that can do it? Halliburton, they're the only ones who can feed our troops and build the bases and that kind of thing. Are there enough companies in America on the border of Halliburton that could carry out this kind of stuff?
I think there are. I mean, 60 Minutes did a story about this last year, and I was interviewed for that story and talked about all these issues about Cheney and Halliburton and all the things we're discussing. And in that story, 60 Minutes found there was a CEO of a small company in Texas who had tried to call the Pentagon and had tried to apply for contracts in Iraq, and no one would return his phone calls, and then when he finally reached someone, they said that they had already given a contract out without any bidding to Halliburton, and he said he had done this kind of work in the Persian Gulf War back in the early 90s, that they had, that his company had experience working with the government on things like securing oil wells and those kinds of issues. And so, you know, the idea, you know, honestly, the idea that there's only one company in the entire universe that can do these functions is sort of a justification to not have any competitive bidding, or to, you know, to not reach too far. And, you know, I don't dispute Halliburton has some expertise, but I do find it specious and not terribly credible that they're the only company. I mean, I just can't believe that they're the only company. And in the case of 60 Minutes, they found another company that wanted to bid and couldn't. And there have been news reports that Bechtel has pulled back and won't bid against Halliburton because they're not persuaded that it's an open and free competition. Now, when we asked them about that news report, they wouldn't talk to us. But the point I'm getting at is I think there is something a little strange here. And, of course, Halliburton has also had some poor performance on their contracts over the years. They've been cited for some problems of mismanagement and other problems. They're, you know, as you know, they're under investigation right now for overcharging the Pentagon and taxpayers in Iraq over gasoline purchases from Kuwait. So,
yeah, I also know they just got a brand new contract Friday.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, we actually are in, you know, staying pretty intensely on this whole subject of contracting inside the Pentagon and what's going on and who's getting these contracts. What we found with Iraq, which we, by the way, we're continuing to post documents and contracts on our website. We're the only site in the U.S. or actually anywhere that has that stuff. And we're actually in U.S. District Court because the State Department and the Army Corps of Engineers would not release the information. So we're going to court to appeal our turned down requests. So anyway, there shouldn't be a lot of mystery about how our money is being spent, but there is. And so anyway, I think it bears scrutiny and that these folks ought to be accountable. And the company, of course, claims that they've done absolutely nothing wrong. And, you know, it's up for the public to decide, but good luck. It took us 73 Freedom of Information Act requests and half a year to try to find out just who was getting the contracts. So that's not a very transparent or open process. And, I have a problem with that.
Well, and speaking of the Freedom of Information Act, and we only have about 5 minutes left here.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
But you talk about in the book, you say Bush's presidency has been characterized by, quote, an unrelenting zeal for secrecy. Say that on page 210.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about, I believe in that same chapter, you bring up the Patriot Act and the Department of Homeland Security Act.
Right.
Both had effects on the Freedom of Information Act. Is that right?
Well, they did. In fact, now part of it is a natural organic reaction to September 11th. There have been 300 rollbacks of the Freedom of Information Act in the state and federal agencies throughout the nation. But this, you know, there have been some very highly publicized things. The Attorney General circulated a memo and said, when in doubt, decline. First time an Attorney General ever kind of undercut the Freedom of Information Act directly. You've had the president's decision to seal off all access to presidential papers involving his father and President Reagan, which upset a lot of people when he did it. First time the White House ever tried to assert control over the archival records of previous presidents. You have the Energy Task Force, where the vice president has gone to court to try to keep records, just information about who was in meetings, not anything beyond that, keep that from the public regarding the Energy Policy Task Force for the administration and their policy being formulated. And so there is a pattern, and the Patriot 2 Act, and Patriot 1 and Patriot 2, we're the ones who posted the Patriot 2 proposed legislation. that had additional rollbacks of the Freedom of Information Act. But, you know, just having thousands of people who have been arrested and we don't know their names, these are all tectonic, huge, really historically significant shifts in the public space and what should be made public. And don't forget, when you're giving all these contracts to Halliburton, and you're giving all these contracts around the world and outsourcing all these things in government, there's no Freedom of Information Act applying to companies. So when you privatize agencies and you privatize contracts, or you outsource them to, you know, the actual interrogations that are going on the ground in Iraq, we're now hearing are actually being done by companies, not U.S. Department of Defense employees. And so the more we do that, the less we know as citizens, because those are being done by companies and they have no freedom of information obligation to the public. And so I have a problem with that. At least we should have a conversation. When we make these decisions, we should know there is a price when you do that. That is not a monetary price. It's an information open society kind of price. And I don't think we've ever had that conversation that I remember in recent years, with not just Bush, with other presidents. It has to do with what should we know, what right do we have to know about our government. I think we have a lot to, we ought to be able to know, because it's our government. It's not, it's supposed to be of, by, and for the people, not certain vendors. And so, anyway, that's why we try to pull as much as we can up onto the web.
On Patriot Act 2, very quickly.
Sure.
I know you guys are the ones who broke the story in the first place, and they denied that such a thing even exists, even after it was already up on your website.
Right.
Is it true that Bush signed major parts of Patriot Act 2 on the day that Saddam Hussein was captured? And I've read in a few places here and there, but I figure since it was leaked to you first, you probably ought to know better than anybody.
Well, I should know better, and that's what scares me. I don't know if that's true what you just said. I haven't heard that, or I mean, I don't know that firsthand. I mean, the problem we have here is, you know, I have to be really blunt. Very few people in this country follow executive orders. There are things the president can do when he can't, like this recess appointment of this judge. He can go around Congress, but he can also, any president, not just Bush, can do executive orders. And there's very few journalists and very few, not just citizens in general, who have the attention span or the energy or the interest to go through the fairly micro minutia of legalese that are in these executive orders. And then there are some that the president can sign and do that are actually classified. So you couldn't go through them if you wanted to, because they're not available. And I just don't know what you just said. I haven't heard that, but it does worry me. They clearly want to do more than Patriot. They want to go forward, and they can't bring back Patriot 2, but they can try to get pieces of it passed. And there's no question they are going to keep trying to do that. And I'm curious myself about what you just asked, but I just don't know, I'm afraid.
Okay, that's it. I'm sorry, we're out of time.
No problem.
Charles Lewis is the founder and the director of the Center for Public Integrity, and I foolishly forgot to write down your website here.
Well, no problem. It's www.publicintegrity.org, O-R-G, and public integrity is one word, so publicintegrity.org.
Great. Hey, thanks so much for coming on the show today, Mr. Lewis.
Well, thank you. Good luck to you, and it was a pleasure.